This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million and tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Well, that was quite a week, wasn't it? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 28th of July. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Yes, there is healthcare to talk about. Also, though, the Fed, economic growth, tax reform as well. The next big thing the GOP says it's going to try to get done. Seems like five-ish minutes should be good to wrap all that up. What do you think? David Gura is at Bloomberg. Rachel Abrams is at the New York Times. They are both in our studios in New York. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey there.
All right, Gura. So listen, it's written down, I think, in the Business Reporter's Code of Conduct that we have to talk about the Fed on Fed meeting weeks. Steady as she goes was the message. We don't have to spend a lot of time, right?
I think so. Yeah. We got a little bit more detail on the balance sheet in that we got two new words to describe what they're thinking of doing that's going to happen relatively soon. They're going to start unwinding or normalizing their balance sheet, getting rid of some of the $4.5 trillion worth of securities they've accumulated here recently. They're going to continue to watch or monitor inflation. Obviously, this is something that's still a sticking point for them. The target is 2%, still well below that. And then their assessment of the labor market is it's pretty good. When you look at that overall, it's in line with what they want to see.
Rachel, to the bigger economic picture, we got gross domestic product figures out this morning for the second quarter, 2.6%, which is nifty, but there's a whole seasonality thing and some revisions downward in prior months, yeah?
Yeah, and we also, I mean, 2.6% is nice, but it doesn't mean that it's going to be sustained. It doesn't mean anything about the long term. And 3% is typically the goal. And typically, the beginning of the year, it's slow growth. Right about now, it picks up a little bit, which is what we're seeing. And then it kind of topples off at the end of the year. So there's nothing to say that we're not going to see that. And this isn't normal, although it gives Trump, the President Trump, a little bit of a win, you know, at a time when he's facing some other kind of embarrassing defeats out of Washington. So,
yeah, speaking of interesting things going on out of Washington, David, do have to mention that as we were walking into the studio here this afternoon, it crosses the wires. Actually, that's not true. It crossed in a tweet from the president that, it, I mean, you know, it's an official
statement
from the White House.
Yeah.
That's what
they
say. That Ryan Priebus is out as the White House Chief of Staff. General John Kelly, the Secretary of Homeland Security, is in as Chief of Staff. This is clearly an attempt to bring order out of the chaos that has been the White House, yeah?
Yeah, I've interviewed him. I've interviewed General Kelly when he became Secretary. He's Secretary Kelly. He's a very intense guy and a guy who is very eager to talk about how he took this position, the former position, out of duty. He was asked to be head of the Department of Homeland Security by President Trump, having never met him before. This came about kind of suddenly for him. It makes sense for me. He's an intense guy. He seems well-liked by those who have worked for him. And this is certainly a radical change from having somebody who headed up the RNC, having a guy firmly in politics running the White House as Chief of Staff. This is going to be something entirely different.
Yeah. Rachel, to your point about 3% GDP growth, which is the thing thing that the White House has been talking about. David had Budget Director Mick Mulvaney on Bloomberg Television this morning in the pouring rain outside the White House. And Mulvaney said, first of all, yeah, we're still counting on 3%. But then he said, and David spun the conversation to tax reform. And David said, so where are we on this? And Mulvaney basically said, everybody in Congress and our negotiators from the White House has agreed we're all on the same page moving forward. Do you buy that, I guess, is the question.
I think it's hard to imagine we're going to see something anytime soon on tax reform. I think that there's a lot of – I think we were supposed to see something this summer. Now we're supposed to see something in the fall maybe. But given all of the problems that the Republicans have had getting health care off the ground, I think that there are some concerns that we're really going to be losing momentum on something like tax reform, which nobody seems to be able to agree even what to cut the corporate rate, what to cut – how to make it simpler for individuals. So I am skeptical that we're going to see anything – tomorrow or maybe even in the fall.
Well, David, he promised the end of the year, didn't he?
He did promise the end of the year. We'll see what happens. You know, I'm struck by how little information we got this week. There was a lot of dissatisfaction when the White House first handed out its plan for tax reform a few months back. It was a page long. We got another page yesterday. Indeed, some others signed on to it, leaders from the House, leaders from the Senate as well. And there was some agreement here not to pursue the border-adjusted tax, but right. This is hardly a thorough plan for tax reform.
Rachel, a very quick swing past American manufacturing on the way out. Big news this week in Wisconsin. Foxconn, the electronics manufacturer, most notably for Apple, is going to build a plant there, as many as 13,000 workers, but with heavy subsidies from the state and the tax base there.
Right. And I think the concern there is that I think it's, what, $3 billion in tax credits or some kind of subsidies to the company. And you're creating, I think if you do the math, you're paying something like, I've seen different numbers, $100,000 per job, but each job might only be paying $50,000-something. So you're paying a lot of money to bring in jobs that won't necessarily kind of go back into the pockets of the taxpayers paying them. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot of concerns that this could be something that, of course, it sounds really great, American manufacturing jobs being created, but at what cost, to your point?
Right. Never a dull moment in the politics of the American economy. Rachel Abrams at The New York Times, David Gurra at Bloomberg, both of them in New York for us today. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you.
All right. Have a nice week. And on Wall Street today, steady as she goes, again, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, a little bit more on taxes because, come on, you can never have too much tax policy, right? As I said, congressional leaders and negotiators from the White House have come to a broad agreement on what they think tax reform is going to look like. That's what Mulvaney was telling David Gurra today. It took them 6 months to get there, hundreds of meetings and listening sessions. And you know what? That was the easy part because the through line of the GOP's tax plan is lower taxes. And making that work without blowing holes in the debt and the deficit is going to require some creativity. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer looked into how they are going to find the money.
One way Republicans could offset the cost of big tax breaks, hit up rich guys like Morris Pearl.
Those people who make more money should pay higher tax rates, and those who make less money should have lower tax rates.
Pearl is a retired financial advisor and chairman of a group called the Patriotic Millionaires, a few hundred wealthy people who say they're willing to pay more in taxes. President Trump has said he wants the wealthy to pay more, but congressional Republicans have focused more on businesses than individuals. They want to pay for a big cut in the corporate tax rate by closing some loopholes, and with a one-time tax on foreign earnings companies bring back to the U.S.
And that actually helps with the short-term budget issues.
That's Len Berman, an economist at the Urban Institute. He says there's also a proposal to end corporate deductions of interest payments. Linda Bilmes, who teaches public policy and finance at Harvard, says what you really need is a tax reform plan
in which we consider all sources of revenue and all kinds of spending.
And that would take bipartisanship, like we saw in the 1986 tax reform law. Back then, Len Berman says, President Reagan would invite House Speaker Tip O'Neill over for a drink to hash things out.
It's hard to imagine the current president doing that with tweets.
But President Trump has made it clear he wants big tax reform, similar to what President Reagan did. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer. for Marketplace.
This morning, JPMorgan Chase said it is going to commit $200 billion to financing clean, sustainable energy. On top of that, divisions across the company, all Chase properties, from retail to real estate, are going to switch to all renewable power by 2020. That's more than 5,000 properties in more than 60 countries. Marketplace's Ryan Kailath explains why the biggest bank in the country is betting so big on wind and solar.
Here's how I imagine the decision went down. In an executive boardroom at JPMorgan Chase one day, a bunch of long-haired hippies were sitting around daydreaming when one of them said, "Hey, I know how to spend all this money. Why don't we save the planet?"
It's like you were in the room.
Erin Roberts, executive director of finance at Chase, and she says protecting the environment is nice, but Chase has been profiting from the green economy for more than a decade.
None of this, frankly, is a new business line. It's continuation of efforts in supporting the industry that we've been in for years.
Hervé Tuati of the Rocky Mountain Institute says Chase's move sends a signal.
One of the messages to corporate America is that renewable energy is no longer for the tree huggers. It's serious business.
Kim Sentara is CEO of TerraPro Solutions, which helps build renewable projects around the country.
The thing that really moves our industry is certainty, and I think it sends a really clear message to all the developers that J.P. Morgan has come forward and been willing to make that kind of commitment.
One of the projects TerraPro worked on is actually a wind farm that'll help power Chase's U.S. properties. Peter Mostow, a clean energy attorney, says the sustainability pledge might seem like greenwashing, but
it's actually one of the most important drivers of the ongoing market demand for renewable energy.
Despite pushback from some state utilities and even the federal government, Mostow says, commitments like this from corporate America are a signal that clean energy is here to stay. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
There's an election in Venezuela this weekend that is bringing the months and years of that country's political and economic crisis to a head. President Nicolas Maduro wants to elect a new National Assembly to rewrite the Venezuelan Constitution. We got the BBC's Will Grant in Caracas on the line earlier today, and I asked him, first of all, what it's like down there right now.
Well, it's been a very intense few weeks. There have been closing off streets. There's been obviously very violent clashes between the two sides on a number of occasions. The protesters, the opposition protesters, and the security forces. We've seen more than 100 people killed over the past 3 months. And it looks like there's no sign of those protests slowing down as we approach this very controversial vote. So Caracas is quite tense in these final few days, but it is simply, in a sense, more of the same. They've been living through weeks of uncertainty and some violence.
There have been also, for months and months, and longer than that probably, lines and queues for food and gasoline and supplies. The opposition leaders now have told their people to go out and stock up. Is that right?
Well, I think that's simply part of daily life now for many, many Venezuelans. They do stock up if they can. The queues, as you say, are around the block. Simply today, I've seen queues for the bank snaking right around the block. There is food available, more so than there was a couple of months ago, perhaps. But now the inflation is so much higher that it's simply trying to afford it is the difficulty for most ordinary Venezuelans. So if the situation gives on the one hand, then it seems to take away on the other. And I'm sensing a real sense of fatigue. People are tired. People have gone days and days without being able to work. We're just coming out of a 48-hour strike, so that made life difficult for people. So there is this sense, perhaps, where some people don't necessarily support the government's push to change the constitution, but they're also tired of the protests.
No matter what happens almost this weekend with this vote, the economic collapse is systemic. So what's the short-term future?
Right. And when you look at the oil price and the fact that it's still, effectively in the doldrums in terms of Venezuelan oil basket, then the outlook's not good. And there are important creditors who need servicing in the coming months. you're right. I think that the economic reality may well be the one that sets the political one in the coming months. This vote is crucial from the government's point of view. They want to push on with what they're saying is part of a broader image or vision for Venezuela that Hugo Chavez had before he died. The difficulty is they've also defended this constitution that they're planning to change so vociferously over the years that it looks like they're changing it simply because they no longer have control of the National Assembly. So that gives weight to the opposition's suggestion that this is a power grab. So it is an extremely complex and tense time in Venezuela, and as I say, many ordinary Venezuelans are simply tired of the status quo.
The BBC's Will Grant in Caracas, Venezuela. Will, thanks very much for your time.
Very welcome.
Coming up,
there's always going to be a group of people that loves the concept of the beach
and loves riding their bikes along it. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 33 points this Friday, a 10%, 21,830. The Nasdaq shed 7 points, about a 10%, 6374. The S&P 500 down 3, a 10%, 2472. For the week, mixed. Dow up 1 and a 10%. Nasdaq down 0.2%, though. The S&P 500 pretty much unchanged Monday through Friday. Exxon sputtered down 1.5% today. Royal Dutch Shell powered up about 0.4%. Tea has soothed nerves for generations in many parts of the globe, but the brew is not hot enough for Starbucks. The coffee company announced it is bagging its Teavana stores and cut its profit forecast. Starbucks poured off more than 9% today. Bonds rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.29%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out Public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We are going to go back to Erie, Pennsylvania here for a little bit to talk schools for our series, The Big Promise. School choice was among the policy promises that Donald Trump made as a candidate. It is the top issue for his Education Secretary, Betsy DeVos. The basic idea being that no matter where they live or how much they make, families ought to be able to choose the best schools for their kids. In rural parts of the country, though, those choices can be hard to come by, which helps explain the rise of cyber charter schools. Kids go to school online on the taxpayer's dime. Marketplace's Amy Scott, our education correspondent, took us to Erie yesterday talking to families from the Pennsylvania Cyber Charter School. Today, what happens to the local brick-and-mortar school in nearby Union City when kids leave? Here's Amy.
Union City, Pennsylvania is a rural town with one elementary school and one middle and high school. Every spring, there's a drive your tractor to school day. In teacher Martha Blair's arts and crafts class, students learn to weave saddle blankets and gun straps.
So they're all learning how to use the looms, but they're making something that's useful for them.
Union City was once known for furniture making, but in the last 15 years, the lumber mills and chair makers have closed. The hospital and newspaper are gone. Dave Robinson directs the Union City Family Support Center, which provides social services for the poor. He also sits on the school board.
Right now, I'd say the one strong institution that kind of keeps the whole community together is the school system.
More families are opting out of that system and sending their kids online. Last school year, 35 students from the district were enrolled in cyber charter schools. That's out of almost 1,100 students. Each child who leaves takes about $10,000 in school funding with them, $20,000 if they have special needs. But Robinson says many of the costs that money helped cover remain.
There's infrastructure in a school district, whether we're educating 1,000 kids or 500 kids.
There are also administrative costs. If cyber students repeatedly don't show up or log on to school,
then we have to send our truancy officer to get involved.
Last year, one student missed 90 days. And when cyber school doesn't work out, kids often come back to the district school, needing extra tutoring and support to catch up. Superintendent Sandra Myers says she's had several high school students return after a few years at an online school.
And they might have accrued all of 2 to 3 credits when we have 28 credits required for graduation. To me, that's a travesty.
At the Pennsylvania Cyber Charter School, where most of the area's online students go, just 55% of students graduate on time. That's statewide. The school has almost 11,000 students. The graduation rate at Union City High is above 95%. PA Cyber CEO Brian Hayden says academic comparisons are unfair. Many families choose cyber school because their kids were struggling at traditional schools.
We're not kidnapping these kids off the street. You know, the families are choosing to come to us.
And there aren't a lot of school choices in rural areas like Union City. Mike and Mary Pandolf sent their kids to a Catholic school in a nearby town until it closed a few years ago because of low enrollment. Mike says they chose PA Cyber for the flexibility.
Especially in my profession as a funeral director, so when I have to go to conventions, these kids can log in at school using the internet from the hotel. So we actually spend more time together.
The Pandolfs say their kids are doing well. 11-year-old Addison is going into sixth grade.
I love that it's just a short day. It's not as long as normal schools are.
Do they ever resist logging in?
No.
No.
Because we always say the option is brick and mortar. You don't want to do it, it's brick and mortar.
Union City's brick-and-mortar school isn't about to take that. To compete, it's trying to spice up its curriculum with a new STEM academy. It even started its own cyber program, though fewer than 10 kids are enrolled. The district is considering doing some advertising to get the word out. In Union City, Pennsylvania, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
If summer means anything, it means spending time outside. Leisure and recreation, hiking, running, playing, going to the beach. So here with the season's last story from our series, Summertime, brought to you by
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by...
You know those bikes you see in beach towns sometimes? Today, the origin story from Marketplace's Andy Euler.
Beach cruisers are ubiquitous in Southern California, like right here in Venice. Riders glide past on candy-colored bikes, the ocean breeze in their hair. Their thick tires easily roll over boardwalk planks or sand. Tina Isaacs, a tourist from Las Vegas, rented one for the day.
Just ride around, look at everything, get some sun.
That's exactly what the beach cruiser was designed for, and designed by this one guy, a Southern California beach native, Larry McNeely.
This building was ready to fall over, and a guy rented it to me for $200 a month.
We met in Huntington Beach, his hometown. He opened a shop called Recycled Cycles here. It was the second in a franchise he started in 1973 when he was 20. Larry and his dad restored antique bikes and sold them to collectors. Larry said there wasn't much variety in new bikes for sale back then.
There were only a couple bikes that were available to the public. One was a Swin Stingray. And the other was the lightweight 10 speeds with racing turndown handlebars and the little tiny seat that went up your butt.
After restoring a bunch of balloon tire Schwinns from the 1940s and 50s, he got an idea.
I'm looking at the overall market, and I go, these people in a tight community like Huntington Beach and Newport, they're only riding their bicycles for short distances. They're not using them as transportation. So we promoted the Beach Cruiser under the comfort, durability, and nostalgia aspects, and that's when it took off.
Larry McNeely and his dad designed a bike where you rode sitting up, with fat tires, low to the ground, vintage details like fenders and bright colors. They built about 7 a week by hand and couldn't keep up with demand.
It went so fast, so big, that I lost control. I didn't have good enough insight to capitalize to its full advantage.
But he did make one really smart move. He trademarked California Beach Cruiser in 1976. The following year, Schwinn came out with the Schwinn Cruiser. Larry hired an attorney.
We filed suit in the Superior Court of California for a trademark infringement, and we settled out of court with a cease and desist.
The next year, he says Schwinn called him. After a two-year negotiation,
we finally agreed that I would take a per-bike payment for every bike they produced.
25 cents a bike. He had to sign a non-compete agreement, which forced Larry McNeely to shut down his three bike shops. Schwinn sales were so good that he says he made about $100,000 a year. That's 1980s dollars, without lifting a finger. The deal didn't last. McNeely ended up having to get a real job designing aluminum baseball bats. Still very summer. As for beach cruisers, they've pedaled right along. You can get one pretty much anywhere that sells bikes, from any number of bike brands.
These are all the fenders, which fenders are kind of a cruiser thing too, you know, like that the wheel covers.
Including a brand called Beach Bikes, also in Southern California. Dustin Geiger co-founded the company 10 years ago. He uses pretty much the same selling points as Larry McNeely in the 70s, a comfortable ride and a lifestyle.
There's always going to be a group of people that loves the concept of the beach. And if you could ride and get a bike and feel that for a few minutes a day, that inspires us here.
And the Beach Cruiser's easy-to-ride design now attracts millions of customers, whether they're tourists renting one for a few hours or college students getting to class. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, the writings of one Anthony Scaramucci. Turns out, and I genuinely didn't know this, that during his time on Wall Street, the new White House communications director wrote three, count them, three self-help books. Erin Gloria Ryan reviewed them today in the Daily Beast. Well, two of them, actually, is all she could stomach. Here, perhaps, is her kindest paragraph. Quote, Scaramucci's writings are the sort of tepid airport business reads that are so aggressively meaningless and derivative that they make the reader worse at writing and possibly worse at thinking. End of quote. As we go out, a reminder that writing might not be Scaramucci's forte, but office politics sure are. His rival, Reince Priebus, has been ousted this afternoon as White House chief of staff. All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 33 points to end the week, 0.1%. The Nasdaq shed 7, 0.1% there as well. S&P 500 down 3, that's about 0.1% there. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have a great weekend, everybody. We are back on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.